So repeatedly generating compassion and using that as a motivating factor for ourselves to practice the Dharma is very, very powerful. And we should do that repeatedly, because compassion is really one of the important aspects of that. Okay. So why is idle talk categorized as destructive speech? Isn't idle talk one of the ways to maintain relationships with other people? Yes, it is one way to maintain a relationship. And there are times when we, you know, just talk pleasantries, and that's fine. But we are aware of doing it, and we have the motivation to do it in order to connect with people. But what the idle talk that's destructive is the idle talk when we're just hanging out, having a good time, liking to hear ourselves talk. Yeah, you like to hear yourself talk? You have your whole repertoire of stories to tell and talk about what this person's doing and that person's doing and the latest soap opera on TV and what the politicians are doing, what the football score was or the badminton score was. Yeah, and so just spending a good part of our life talking about things that have no real significance. And so this is especially damaging for people who are Dharma practitioners, because they could be using their time in a different way to cultivate the path. And I know for myself sometimes, you know, there's the times when I engage in, you know, just talking about pleasantries with the intention to just make a connection with people. There's times when I just kind of get lost and having a good time and telling stories and talking about nothing much in particular. And that needs to be stopped from my side. And then there's times when I really have, you know, I have to write books, I have to take care of the people at the Abbey, I have to travel, and somebody's, you know, talking to me, telling the same story that they told me again, asking me a question, and I give an answer, and then they ask the same question again in a different way, and I give an answer, and they ask the same question again, and then they go off on long story, and then they're this and that, and it's quite disturbing, you know. So I know when I'm with my teachers, when I'm with people, it doesn't matter, lay or monastic, if they're serious practitioners, then I try to make my speech, you know, concise and to the point, and something that needs to be said, not just, you know, blah, 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 blah. You know what I mean? Okay, so that's why it's classified as a destructive action. Okay, so how to overcome thinking rationally versus following our heart? I don't think we should overcome thinking rationally. I think we should know how to think rationally. And we should also know how to follow our heart and when to follow our heart. And when to check whether our heart is following reason or whether our heart is involved in affliction. Okay? So this is the kind of stuff that comes with practice and with really observing one's own life and one's own mind. Okay? So, you know, we need to think using reason and clear modes of thinking to discriminate what to practice on the path and what to abandon on the path. And when we do that, it can often bring very strong feelings of faith and confidence in the three jewels. So it's not that rational or reasoning thinking is contradictory to faith, but it actually enhances it. Yeah, because when we can really discern something very clearly and see the truth in something that before we were blind to, then it causes a great deal of trust and confidence in the Buddhas to arise in our own mind. Okay? And so that's a kind of emotional feeling that, yes, of course, we want to follow, and that can be very helpful in our practice. The kind of emotional feeling that we don't want to follow is when we're angry, when we're, you know, have this mind that says, I need this, I want this, I have to have this. Okay? So that's not so good. Or sometimes we get even a little emotional about the Dharma, in the sense that there's some people who have what I call ordination fever. So there are usually people that are new to the Dharma, and of course the Dharma rings true in their hearts, and then they have the idea, I want to ordain immediately! Immediately! And they go and request ordination, and they push and push and push, and some other older students may say, you know, just go slowly, establish a good foundation, check out all the situations of what's going to happen, where your teacher is, who's going to train you, where you're going to live after you ordain. Take it slowly and really think about things and set up something good for yourself. But these people say, no! I want to ordain immediately because the Dharma speaks to my heart. And there's a certain amount of drama with it all. So I remember some years ago, there was a program, and one woman was at it. It was a Dharma program. And she had this, what I call, ordination fever. And a couple of other senior nuns and I sat down with her and told her, you know, just what I said about going slowly and, you know, making sure who's going to train you, where you're going to live, you know, what are you going to do. But she just didn't want to hear any of it, you know, and she got quite mad at us, actually. And as it turned out, I don't know what happened, but she didn't work. Anyway, years later, must have been at least, I don't know. Anyway, many years later, I was teaching a course, and she was a participant in the course, and she came up to me and she said, thank you so much for back then telling me to take it slowly. Yeah. So it was very interesting to see the change, you know, the time had brought, because she was really mad at but so you see, that kind of listening to your heart, it was filled with too much emotion that she had and not enough clear thinking. Yeah. So that's how we have to tell, you know, when are we thinking clearly and when aren't we? Mm-hmm. And when sometimes there's really a very sincere, in-depth feeling in our heart, and when to follow it, because it's supported by experience or by reasoning, and it's not just this, you know, I have intuition that. Okay? So it's something, this balance you learn from your own experience. Okay, and sometimes we find it difficult to live a balanced life, how to overcome the dilemma. Practice. Yeah? I wish I could tell you a certain pill that they have at the pharmacy that they, you know, that you could buy and it would solve your dilemma of being imbalanced, but you know, they haven't invented those pills yet, and I don't think they're ever going to be able to. Yeah. It depends what you're trying to get balanced. There's many aspects of our life to balance. This is quite a, it's a more general question than really I can answer. I'm going to try and go through these questions quickly so we can have some teachings also. So what would your best advice be for people suffering from cancer and from cancer survivors in remission? They contemplate impermanence, but at times fear arises due to the uncertainty. What would be the best way to overcome this fear and hopefully change their karma? First of all, once a karma starts ripening, you can't make it unripen. Okay? So you can prevent harmful karma from ripening in the future. When we face great illness, there's a few different ways that are very effective. The taking and giving meditation that I described yesterday, imagining taking on the suffering of others and then giving them our happiness. I described it just briefly. There's a longer description of it in this book. And if you look on my website under taking and giving, there's a more extensive explanation. And the most extensive explanation is in a book by one of my teachers called Transforming Adversity into Joy and Courage. And chapter 11 of that book gives a very full explanation of the taking and giving meditation. So I really recommend that. I'll tell you another story about how somebody I knew handled a situation of severe illness. She wasn't feeling well and went to the doctor, and the doctor gave her a diagnosis. I can't remember what it was for, but it was terminal. And she was young, she was in her early 30s with a terminal diagnosis. And she, you know, with cancer, you don't know if you're in remission. You may not die of cancer. My mom had cancer. She did not die of cancer. She died of something else later on. But anyway, so this friend was, you know, when she thought, like, uh-oh, okay, my life is going to take a 180-degree turn right now. What would His Holiness the Dalai Lama do in this situation? And she said what just came into her mind is His Holiness would just be kind. So she made that determination, you know? Whatever treatment I have to go through, whether I live, whether I die, I'm going to be fine, not only to my, I'm going to be kind, not only to my family and friends, but also to the doctors, the nurses, the technicians, the other staff people in the hospital. I'm just going to spend the rest of my life being kind in whatever way I can. And she said that once she made that decision, her mind really settled down. Because then she saw, you know, whether you live or whether you die, you know, what else is there to do but just be kind? And we never know how long we're going to live anyway. And as it turned out, it was quite interesting. After a while, they ran some more tests, and whatever she had been suffering from, either it was gone or it was misdiagnosed. And she was okay after that. Yeah. But that thought of, you know, my job is just to be kind, I think is very, very helpful for anything we face in life. So my daughter wants a rare small tortoise as her pet. And I'm considering about the tortoise's well-being, as we are unable to provide the natural living environment. I don't really have anything wise to say about that. You know, see what you can provide. See if the tortoise can be happy in that. Tortoises can live in different environments. So I think it would be better to contact somebody who's a specialist in tortoises. I'm not, so excuse me. So my sister used to love me very much, and then she did something that was very hurtful to me many years ago, and I'm keeping this sadness and deep hurt feelings in my heart. How do I help myself that go? We discussed this yesterday in terms of forgiving people, yeah, and just deciding to let go of the anger and deciding to let go of the hurt. Yeah? Because we often say, you hurt me, as if the hurt started out at the other person and then went like this, you know, and clung onto us. But when we examine more deeply, very often hurt feelings come because we had an expectation of how the relationship was going to work out, or an expectation of the future, or a dream, or we took things for granted. But something was going on in our side where we had a quite strong idea of how things would be or should be. And then, of course, as they say, life happens. And life happens means we can't control everything. And all sorts of stuff we never ever expected come our way, including people not acting the way we thought they would act or should act or want them to act. And there's, you know, nothing much we can do about it. We can yell and scream. We can accuse them of hurting us. We can be mean back to them, but none of it actually benefits them. And it's like I was saying yesterday with the U.S. foreign policy of, we're going to bomb you until you do it my way. It doesn't work. Because we can bother other people and get angry at them and make them suffer, but that's not going to make them love us and do things our way. So I think I mentioned yesterday I have this little slogan that I often tell myself. which is sentient beings do what sentient beings do. Okay? A sentient being is a being with a mind who is not yet a Buddha. And particularly ordinary sentient beings, not Aryas, but ordinary sentient beings, whose minds are really overwhelmed with afflictions and karma, they do all sorts of things without thinking clearly, because they're just pushed by the force of the afflicted mind and by their previous karma. So sentient beings do what sentient beings do. If they were Buddhas who did that, then I might be a little bit surprised. Yeah, because Buddhas act with compassion and generosity and wisdom and skillful means. But sentient beings don't. So why am I expecting them to be like Buddhas? That expectation is my problem. Why am I so disappointed in others? Because I'm holding unreal expectations. Yeah? They're sentient beings. What do I want from them? It's like if somebody came and said to me, "Oh, I love you very much, and in return, I expect you to always love me back, always do what I want you to do, always make me happy, always encourage me when I'm sad, always be in a playful mood when I want to joke around. I expect you to do all this and be my friend forever and never to do anything that is ever going to bother me." So if somebody came to you and said that, what would you say? Yeah, I'd say bye-bye, wouldn't you? You'd say, "I can't do that. I can't be everything you want me to be." Yeah. So if that's what we would say if somebody had that kind of unrealistic expectation of us, then if we see we have an unrealistic expectation of others, then we should maybe consider letting that go. Because there's no way somebody else is going to meet it. And it happens sometimes that people we trust very much do things that seem totally out of character, or they do things that hurt us very badly, or betray our trust. And you know what? When that happens, we feel like, "Wow, I'm the only person who's ever experienced that kind of hurt and pain." But you know, if you start talking to every single person in this room, everybody's experienced that. Haven't you experienced a lot of hurt and pain in interpersonal relationships? Thinks we all have. Of course, none of us are the people that cause other people pain. Right? It's always them who are so inconsiderate and selfish that cause us pain. But we never do anything to disturb other people's peace of mind, do we? Okay. With that, I think we should move on. So I wanted to talk about a few other different aspects of karma that you may find interesting and also helpful. First, to just run through quickly the 10 non-virtuous actions and the 10 virtuous ones, so that we'll recall what to abandon and what to practice. So there's three to abandon that we do physically. Killing, yeah, so not only human beings, but cockroaches, mosquitoes, ants, and I will not take any questions asking me what to do when your house is infested with ants. Because people ask me that question all the time, hoping that I will give them permission to kill the ants. And I'm sorry, I cannot do that. Okay? So, killing, stealing. So this also, it isn't just breaking into someone's house in the middle of the night. It's taking property that belongs to your workplace that is not designated for you. It's borrowing things or borrowing money and not returning it. How many library books do you have at home? How many people have you borrowed money from that you just so happen to forget to repay? Okay? All that else is stealing as soon as we consider the object ours. Unwise and unkind sexual behavior. Okay? So this is principally if you're in a relationship, going outside your relationship, or even if you aren't in a relationship, going with somebody who is in one. Okay? Doesn't matter, married or not married, it's whether you have a relationship. It also, I think, includes having unprotected sex in this day when there's sexually transmitted disease. I think that's unkind and unwise sexual expression. And also using people for our own pleasure without caring about them emotionally. So letting them get involved with us emotionally, but you know, you're just using them for your own pleasure. That's not very kind. So those three are done physically. Then there's the four verbal ones we talked about yesterday. Lying, divisive speech, harsh words, idle talk. And then there's the last three are mental. So coveting other people's things. Yeah. So just in your mind, looking at other people's stuff and saying, wow, that's really nice. I wonder how I can get that. I wonder how maybe I can drop some hints and they'll give that to me. Yeah. So planning how to get things that aren't ours. The second one is malicious thought. Yeah. And we could do entire meditation sessions on coveting and or malicious thought. Yeah? You can sit in perfect meditation posture. Yeah, your eyes closed, you're not moving a muscle, but your mind is completely daydreaming about all the things that you want and that you're gonna get. Okay, that's coveting. Or, yeah, you're in meditation posture and you're thinking with a mind of malice how to get even with the people who've hurt you. Have you ever done that? Whole meditation session. Oh, this person did that to me. Then they did this to me. Then they said that. Oh, how dare they? Oh, I can't believe they really said that. This is all going in and on inside you. This is somebody I like. This is somebody I trusted. They spoke to me this way. That can't be. I've got to set things right. You know? For their sake, I've got to really bring it home to them. They cannot continue to act this way towards me or towards anybody else. You know, how can I do that? Let's see, I know they're sensitive about this. I can talk about that, and that'll really get them and hurt their feelings. And then, let's dedicate the merit. Yeah? Whole meditation session. Clear visualization. The person you're angry with and visualization of how you're going to harm them so clear. Yeah? No distraction at all. No sleepiness at all. Wide awake, planning your revenge. Yeah. So don't say you can't concentrate. Yeah. You can. It's just you concentrate on the wrong things. Okay. So that's malice. And then the 10th one is wrong views. So this is negating things that exist. And here it's important things, okay? So for example, saying, and this is saying with certainty, it's not just because you're curious and you haven't made up your mind, but saying, I don't believe in rebirth, total garbage. I don't believe in karma. You can do whatever you want and there's no effects from it. And I don't believe in all this stuff about enlightenment and awakening. You know, that's just fanciful thinking. After we die, we're dead. Basta, finito, that's it. Okay? So holding on to really strong wrong views. And the problem with that is that when you hold those views, then you don't take care with your ethical conduct and you wind up creating a lot of negative karma. Okay? Being curious, not having yet made up your mind about what you believe, that's not wrong views. Yeah, you're still in the process of exploring. And so continue to ask questions, discuss, think about it. That's how you learn. Okay. So those are the 10 non-virtues. The 10 virtues, there's actually two types of 10 virtues. One is just not doing the 10 non-virtues. So, you know, there's a situation where you could very easily lie and you say to yourself, no, I'm not going to. There's a situation where you could really easily, you know, just blow up at somebody and say who knows what, and you decide, no, I'm not going to. Okay? So just abandoning a negative action accumulates virtue. In addition, doing the opposite of that negative action. So in the case of killing, actively protecting life. In the case of stealing, respecting and safeguarding others' property. In the case of divisive words, constantly speaking in ways that create a harmony amongst the people that you know. Okay? So actively doing the opposite. Okay, so all these create virtuous karma. Another way related to this is by taking and keeping precepts. So some of you may have taken the 5 lay precepts, or maybe some of them, maybe you're not ready to take all of them yet. And so those 5 are to abandon killing, stealing, unwise and unkind sexual behavior, lying, and intoxicants. Yeah, the reason for intoxicants is that when you take intoxicants, then you probably do all sorts of crazy things and break your other precepts. Okay? So, whenever, if you're a person who's taken precepts, whenever you are keeping those precepts and you are not breaking them, then you are accumulating merit. You're accumulating good karma. So, for example, there may be 2 people sitting here in this room. One of them has taken the precept not to kill. The other one hasn't. Neither one of them are killing right now. The person who's taken the precept not to kill is accumulating the good karma of abandoning killing, because they took that precept and they're living according to it, and they are abandoning killing. The other person who doesn't have the precept isn't killing right now, but they're not creating the merit of abandoning killing because they don't have that intention to do that. Okay? So this is the benefit of taking and then keeping the precepts after you've taken them, is that there's a constant accumulation of good karma. And when you've kept precepts after a while, you can feel that accumulation of good karma in yourself. There's something about how you feel about yourself changes. Okay, so that's one thing I wanted to mention about karma. Another thing is collective and individual karma. Okay, so when we join a group and a group has a certain purpose and we agree with that purpose and join the group and do the activities, then we accumulate karma together with the other people. And also, even if we didn't ourselves necessarily do the action that for which the group was formed, but we rejoice at other people doing it, then we also accumulate that karma. At the same time, when we're members of different groups, we also create individual karma. And likewise, there's different times in our life where we're not acting specifically as a member of a group or doing anything with a group, and we again create individual karma. Okay, so for example, this weekend we've been having the retreat. Yeah. We came together for the purpose of hearing, thinking, and meditating on the Dharma, for the purpose of purifying our mind and creating merit. Yeah. So we all came together for that purpose. We're all participating together. So we create that collective karma together. And the collective karma that we create can ripen in us, because this is virtuous karma, can ripen in us meeting in a future, this life or future lives, in a very happy situation in which we experience the agreeable result of the virtuous karma that we are creating together as a group. Yeah. So hopefully we'll meet again in other Dharma centers, settings, and be able to continue to study and practice together. At the same time that we're creating this group karma, we're also creating individual karma. So some people can be sitting here in the room thinking, wow, this is really interesting. I'm learning so much. I'm going to really take these teachings home and practice them. Yeah, and so that person, by the power of what they're thinking when they're sitting here listening, they have a good intention, they're creating virtuous karma on an individual level. Somebody else may be sitting here in the room going, this is so boring. I could be home sleeping now. When is she going to be quiet so I can do that? So that person is not accumulating such good karma, are they? Okay. So you can see that even within the collective karma, some people are accumulating good karma, individual karma, and some people are accumulating harmful individual karma. Okay. So it's very important that we be careful what groups we join. Mm-hmm. So, you know, because some groups, like an army, yeah, what's the purpose of the army? ostensibly to defend the country. But what do people do? They kill. Okay. So I know that sometimes you're conscripted, there's no choice, you have to go. Yeah, but in that case, then you very consciously think, I do not agree with this. And I'm only doing it because I have to, you know, or you take other means to try and get out of going. Yeah. So it's important to be careful of what groups we join. Sometimes, you know, at sports stadiums, people get really rowdy and they start fighting and all. So you have to be careful if you're going to something, you know, with the hidden agenda to get really kind of revved up and maybe get in a fight because you want to fight people, you know, because then even if you're not the one who fights, if somebody else in the group is, then you also accumulate that similar karma. Yeah. Whereas when you come together as a group to practice the Dharma, yeah, then your virtuous karma increases because, you know, you're doing what the group set out to be, and you're also rejoicing at what other people are doing. So they say that practicing in a group versus practicing alone, and this is just a general statement because clearly for some people it's better to practice alone, but as a general statement, they say it's like the difference between trying to sweep the floor with a broom and trying to sweep it with one little strand from a broom. Yeah? So individually, you have your little strand. It's going to take a while. When you join together with a group and practice with a group, then it's like you're part of that broom sweeping the floor. Okay? So, you know, really make an effort to join virtuous groups and to not join non-virtuous groups. Okay? There's another thing I wanted to talk about. What was it? Yes, rejoicing. That when we rejoice at other people's actions, then we create some of the same karma that they are creating. So again, we have to be very careful what we rejoice at. If you're reading a newspaper and, you know, a politician that you don't like dies and you go, oh good, now I'm gonna get rid of it. Or even you're thinking about the war in the Middle East and, you know, what ISIS is doing, and then you hear that so many ISIS, Dashal, I think you call it here, you call it Dashal. What's the word in Malaysia? We call ISIS in the US. You know what I'm talking about? Okay. So anyway, so you hear in the newspaper, oh, so many ISIS fighters have died, and you go, oh, that's good. I'm so glad they got killed. Yeah? Then you're rejoicing in somebody else's non-virtuous action of killing. So you have to be really careful about that kind of stuff. Whereas if we make an effort to rejoice at other people's virtue, then we accumulate virtuous karma. So they say that if we rejoice in the virtue of somebody else who is kind of at our level of practice, then we create the same amount of virtue that they're doing by doing the action. So let's say a family member makes a donation, you know, offers dana, or a family member comes to the retreat and they listen to teachings and they create karma that way, and you rejoice in the karma of your the virtuous karma of your family members, you create the same kind of karma that they do. If you rejoice in the virtuous karma of people who are more advanced than you are on the path, then you create even more good karma than if you did the action, because you're rejoicing at what they did. Yeah? So it's always very good to rejoice at the Buddha's actions, at the Bodhisattva's actions, the Arhat's actions, because these beings are more spiritually advanced than us. And when you really think about how they live their lives and what they do, it's so inspiring, and it makes your mind happy, and in addition, you create so much virtuous karma. Okay? So very good practice to rejoice. In fact, they say that rejoicing is the lazy person's way to create good karma. Okay? So you can do it even when you're lying in your bed. Yeah? So no excuses when you're sick. You can't say, oh, I'm too sick to do anything virtuous. You can lie there and rejoice that everybody else is virtue. And it'll make you feel better. Okay? So there's many, many ways to create virtue when we understand karma and when we know how to use the principles of karma to our own advantage. When other people make offerings and set up the altar every day, you rejoice at their virtue, okay? Somebody abandons doing a negative action, you rejoice at that. Somebody went to a retreat, somebody took precepts, you rejoice. Yeah. On the other hand, you know, discouraging somebody from doing virtue is not very good either. Like we were saying yesterday, somebody wants to make a donation to a charity and you say, don't do that, let's save it for our vacation. So be careful about those kinds of things. Okay. So, any last minute questions here about karma? Okay. So, you know, we just touched on this topic briefly. There's a lot to understand, yeah. I would recommend this book, Good Karma. I would also recommend His Holiness is writing a series of books about the path to enlightenment, and volume one is out. That's the volume, I saw it on the table out there, Approaching the Buddha's Path. Volume two comes out in May. And volume two has several chapters on karma that are really quite a complete explanation. And so that book is called The Foundation of Buddhist Practice. And it comes out in May, so you can get that one and study up some more. Okay. So let's dedicate our merit and then we'll take a break. Come back for some meditation. Okay, so again, let's rejoice at our own virtue. Rejoice at the virtue everybody here created. Not only this morning, but the virtue we created yesterday and also Friday night. And think of all the virtue and goodness in the world and rejoice in that. And all the virtue of the Arhats and Bodhisattvas and Buddhas. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate.
is forevermore.